Hi, I'm Lori Jones, president and CEO of Avaset Communications and host of the Integrate and Ignite Marketing Podcast. Join me and my guests, some of the world's top innovators, disruptors, and visionaries, as we explore bold and brave marketing strategies for scaling and growing your brand. Tim Sheehy, CEO of Bridger Aerospace, is a maverick entrepreneur that is not only inspiring, but also a leader with an extraordinary story to tell. Listen in as Tim and I discuss the importance of understanding the customer, how to balance innovation and visionary ideas with customer readiness, the risky and expensive nature of being an early adopter, the various stages of financing, including private equity and venture capital, his experience in going public on NASDAQ through an IPO, and the challenges in managing people and hiring the right individuals during fast growth. And don't forget to check out the most recent issue of the Home of the Brave newsletter on LinkedIn. Just like this episode, it's full of inspiration and a ton of ideas that will elevate your strategies and marketing know-how. Welcome to the show, Tim. Welcome to the Integrate and Ignite podcast. I am so excited to have Tim Sheehy join the show today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I tell you, you have an amazing, amazing background. You are currently the CEO of Bridger Aerospace. You're a Navy SEAL, Bronze Star, and Valor at the United States Navy Academy. I mean, amazing stuff here. Tell us a little bit about your journey that ultimately fed your entrepreneurial spirit.
Well, I went to the academy right out of high school. So at 18, went to Annapolis and, joined the military during a time of war. So my wife and I met at the academy. Oh. And of course, the post 9/11 timeframe was, two wars ended up being our longest war in American history. And it was a different environment. And I think what we look at as we look at America being more divided in a lot of ways, one of those divides is, the civilian warrior divide. We've got an emerging warrior class that especially was hardened during OEF and OIF, where, the military became a family business. It became kind of a social caste where either, my wife is military, her brothers are military, all our best friends are military. So either you lived in a world where everyone was military, or like most Americans, you live in a world where you don't know anyone in the military, or maybe you have a cousin or somebody distant, but you don't feel the impacts of continuous deployments every day. So my wife and I entered that world pretty early, right at 18. And of course, 5 days after I graduated the academy, I was in SEAL training. And 3 days after SEAL training, I was getting ready to head overseas on my first deployment. So, during the war, obviously wars, I should say, op tempo was high. My wife and I saw each other about 45 days spread across 6.5 years during combat deployments. And she was a Marine, I was a SEAL. And I never really expected to start a business, be an entrepreneur, but, life works in mysterious ways. And after I got wounded and injured a couple of times, I was no longer able to be a SEAL. So we decided to settle down, settle back in Montana, start our businesses. And we thought maybe we'd have 10 employees one day. And we've grown a lot bigger than that. We're very proud of our business.
Here you are. Yeah. All those years later. Well, first of all, thank you and your wife for the incredible service and quite frankly, the freedom that you've provided every U.S. citizen. So that is just something at the heart of who we are as a country. And I cannot thank you enough for that. And by the way, we have an Army attack helicopter on our team here as well. So we are a veteran loving company. And again, thank you for everything that you've done. So that really fed this entrepreneurial spirit that you and your wife have. Bring us back to the basement, the garage, whatever that, that moment was that you were sitting down and finally deciding that you were going to take the bull by the horns and do something.
Yeah, it was actually a barn. So Roger was a barn. But yes, we, as a ground force commander overseas over several deployments, I'd used and been a beneficiary of a very advanced close air support system that involved ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. And during these most recent wars, what that manifested itself in was aircraft with sensors mounted to them that would provide ground teams real-time situational awareness of what was going on around them. Infrared imagery, electro-optic imagery, synthetic aperture radar, signals intelligence, a whole suite of information that would make our job safer and make us more effective on target. And being the recipient of that data on the ground as a SEAL team leader, I saw really how powerful it was. And, you know, kind of in the back of my mind on one of my Afghan deployments said, man, this is really fascinating stuff. It would be great to provide this to a broader community than just the military. Widen the aperture on this. There's so many more things we could do with this technology than just fight wars with it. You know, and kind of put in the back of the head, and maybe I'll talk about that, you know, if I ever get out of the military. And I didn't expect to get out anytime soon, but, you know, about 4 years after I had that idea, you know, I had, you know, my latest injury and kind of spelled the end of my SEAL career. And my wife and I talked and said, listen, why don't we just give this a shot? It's an interesting idea. And if I had to rewind, you know, and get myself now, I would say, what the hell are you thinking? You know, you're 20,
you had a 1 year old kid. Yeah.
We had all of our savings, but, you know, we were too dumb to know any better. So we decided, yeah, let's just start a company in our barn. Let's just go and spend all of our money in 6 months to do this. And thank God it worked, you know, through a ton of hard work, an amazing group of co-founders and early employees and interns and family, of course. You know, we made it happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and the vision was always to bring that aerial surveillance and close air support concept from the war and apply it to civilian tasks to save lives. And really where that's manifested itself for us is wildland fire. You know, how we fight fire from the air is pretty antiquated. And we've tried to be a force for innovation and progress in that realm. And I'm proud to say, you know, in the last 9 years, you know, we've done that, created about 400 jobs in all of our different enterprises. We've spun out and grown. And it's been a fantastic journey.
Well, congratulations on that. And really what you're talking about is product market fit. What kind of research went into determining that, you know, forest firefighting was going to be the right fit for the business model?
Well, oddly enough, it was a total accident, you know, to be honest.
Those accidents lead to greatness.
Totally. I mean. Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of the fail fast experiment with things that can be expensive, but it's, you know, investing in little experimental projects and failing it is expensive on the face of it, but it's actually far less expensive than not experimenting and investing in things that you are convinced are right. And then before long, you're too far down the path to redirect and you know, you've got a failed enterprise on your hands. So, you know, our first mission was border security. We felt that our aviation-based surveillance could help secure the southern border. And in 2014-15, that just wasn't a priority at that time for the administration. And we literally by accident here in Montana, the local Forest Service office heard we were flying around with an infrared camera. They had been interested in kind of experimenting with that technology with wildland fires. And they reached out to us and said, listen, you know, that type of aircraft with that type of camera, would you be willing to work with us this summer on a fire contract? And, you know, that was right about the time I was running out of money. And I said, well, listen, if you're paying, I'm flying because, you know, I'm broke at this point. And sure enough, you know, we went out and flew our first summer of fires in 2015. And right away, you know, saw, as you said, product market fit. You know, what we were offering was really what the customer needed. And we were offering, you know, that kind of military capability at a much lower price point. And things just took off.
And you mentioned lower price point. So what kind of competition do you have? And how did you ward them off to supply, you know, the market with a new fit?
Well, you know, it's a balance. You know, every customer's got their own complexion, and obviously, mm-hmm. understanding your customer is key to being an effective, you know, salesperson and business builder. And with this particular customer, they're not huge fans of change. You know, the Forest Service, the land management agencies that oversee our wildland fire industry, you know, they want what they want, they like what they know, and they're usually not in a huge hurry to change that. So, trying to come in with a totally radically new approach. With this customer was just that was a recipe for failure. And we'd seen other companies try that where mm-hmm. they were going to come in and tell the agency, you know, how they were so screwed up and how to do things better. And they just weren't interested in hearing that. So what we were able to do is offer them the type of aircraft, a twin commander that they already really liked and believed in, offer them the service that largely aligned with what they already were doing. But in that, you know, inserting our technology and capabilities in kind of an evolutionary manner instead of a revolutionary manner, because sometimes bureaucracies are not ready for revolution. And in fact, they'll resist right. it, even if it will make their job way easier or way more effective. The fact that it's so radically changing to how they do business causes them to take pause. So, you know, giving them something they know and are comfortable with, and then gently evolving that, you know, with some incremental improvements is oftentimes for that type of customer, the best way to do it. And, you know, by doing so, a lot of the competitors, frankly, have been giving them the same thing for 20, 30, 40 years. You know, nothing had changed, literally the same exact airplane. So I think when we were coming in and showing that we were investing in our aircraft and new technology and new techniques, you know, the customer appreciates that, like anybody right. does. Customer appreciates when they're a service provider or product provider is leaning forward and trying to be better every day. You know, they know it costs money for you to experiment. They know it costs money for you to put a, you know, a new cockpit in an aircraft or a new type of sensor. And I think that really set us apart from a lot of our competitors, that we were in fact showing a willingness and in fact a determination to innovate and do things better.
Yeah, I love it. You bring up a very interesting point, and I think it's something very important a lot of people need to be listening to. And there's evolution, but then there's innovation as well. And you were very, very methodical about not providing something that was going to be too much for the buyer to ultimately understand and feel comfortable with. And I think quite often people just go innovation straight away. And there's that big gap, that market mm-hmm. gap on acceptability, need, whatever it might be, perceived need. How did you really methodically say to yourself, wait a minute, we probably need to slow this down a little bit from a technology standpoint so that ultimately we can get the buyer to believe in what we're doing. And dare I say no to a lot of the current vendors that were on the table.
Yeah. Do you know when the first video teleconferencing tool came out? Are you familiar?
No, no, I'm not.
Yeah. Take a guess. So when do you think?
Okay. I'm going to say 1967.
Well, yeah, you're actually, you know, most people say like 99. Yeah, it was a 1964 World's Fair, the AT&T Bell, or the Bell picture phone, they called it.
Wow.
And it was a telephone with a screen on it that you would have in your house, and you pick up the phone and you'd see the video of someone else mm-hmm. on there.
Very cool.
It failed, totally failed, you know? And people thought, why would you want to see somebody you're on the phone with? The whole point of phone is you're not seeing them. And, mm-hmm. you know, for 50 years, 40 years, that was, you know, it was a failed experiment. And then, of course, now what we're doing now, I mean, everything's about video, and you know, the customer wasn't ready for that revolution yet. And I think, but over the next 30 years, as we saw smartphones and then, you know, independent, you know, television became a more dominant source of entertainment. By, you know, 2000, video teleconferencing was something people were ready for. And of course, now today it's considered essential. So, you know, I think, you know, anyone who's in a technology space with their product or their service, you know, you have to balance what you view, because sometimes as a visionary, you'll see something that you know should be happening, but your customer won't be ready for that yet, whether it's a consumer, whether it's a business, whether it's a government, and you have to temper the enthusiasm to jump all the way to Z, because that can be very, very expensive, and it can be a huge failure by jumping so far ahead of where the customer is ready for.
It's that early adoption mindset. And if you are going to take that leapfrog approach, then you better make sure that you've got a handful of clients that are willing to not take the risk, but be there along with you for the ride.
Yeah. And first mover advantage is great. And you know, but it's not always the right answer. And sometimes being the first mover can fail. You can bankrupt your business because you are investing a tremendous amount you know, to invest in something the customer is not yet ready to adopt. And frankly, we saw this, you know, during our business, you know, in 2015, 16, you know, we saw a desire from the customer for this innovation, but they were not ready. You know, we had some evolutionary improvements. They were not ready for revolution for how this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the military was seeing some of the technology we developed for our fire business, and they were ready for a leapfrog in certain capabilities. And therefore, our fire business continued to operate. And of course, I still know today, it's been a very successful business. And obviously, it's a great company. But we spun our technology, some of our technology, into a separate business because that customer was more hungry for instant innovation in that regard.
Yeah.
because they had, at that time, they were fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, and they were dealing with an asymmetric aerial threat in the form of Iranian weaponized drones that were attacking our troops in the fight against ISIS. And our traditional air defense systems were not able to detect and defeat those. And using a lot of the sensors we developed to fight wildfires, we adapted those to a more capable and flexible air defense system that could protect our troops from those aerial threats. So, you know, we were able to pivot, still be innovative and still develop next generation technology. But, you know, this customer wasn't quite ready to receive it. So, you know, another customer was, and we pivoted, you know, and frankly spun out a whole section of the business to attack that customer base, because it was clear, you know, we had two customers that were diverging in their desires. So we went ahead and diverged with them and divided and conquered.
You know, it's a very interesting point. In a lot of situations, I think most CEOs or companies, C-suites would say, okay, we're just going to have a different product line. Mm-hmm. Instead, you developed a whole new company for that audience, which is, I'm sure, involved a lot of conversations at the board table, you know, determining what was going to be the right move.
Well, it started as a product line. And then eventually, you know, the beauty is early on, you know, we didn't have a boardroom. It was me and my founder.
Yeah, it's all like in our, you know, a vision of one.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It could be hay bales for you, you know, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. And there, and you know, boards can be great. Boards can be great mentors and, you know, centering, you know, forces for, you know, a founding team that wants to do everything. They can also inhibit innovation too at times. And luckily at that point in time of our company, we didn't have any sort of board structure. It was just a bunch of founders, me and my brother and a bunch of others together. And we saw this opportunity. And initially we addressed it with a product line, you know, just under the Bridger banner. But then, you know, there's other forces that exist in the marketplace. Number one is regulation. You know, if you're going to sell to the DOD, there's a whole suite of requirements that come with that, like your accounting system and your IT system and all this other stuff that we said, well, we don't want to have to contaminate the, you know, our core business with that. So let's do a spin out. That way we don't have to have DCA accounting and mm-hmm. SOX compliance and all this other stuff at Bridger. Let's have a, you know, kind of subsidiary that does that. And then of course, financial investment started to come along, and, you know, one company was distinctly becoming a fast growing technology product company, technology product sales. And one was becoming an asset-based service company, owning and flying planes on a contract. So more of a 5 to 10 year earnings horizon, vice, you know, a short-term kind of technology earnings. So that financial base is fundamentally different. You know, one appeals to venture capital and one appeals more to asset-backed finance, which those two don't always mix well. So that was another reason why splitting those made sense, because, you know, banks love assets and they love stability and contracts and you know, revenue contracts.
And government contracts at that.
Right. And venture capitalists, you know, that they see assets and balance sheet and government contracts and go, ugh, you know, we want high growth technology. So that was another driver there, is because, you know, we bootstrapped everything for the first few years, just, you know, every cent we had and, you know, maxed out our credit cards and second mortgages and all that. But then, you know, we got to a point where outside finance was really going to be needed to take us to the next level. And that was another reason why, you know, splitting those companies made sense.
And then enter stage right, you decided to deploy a SPAC.
Yeah, you know, again, but, you know, obviously there, I've been, had an interesting financial journey with my companies, from literally every cent in my pocket, founding it with my own money. And then, you know, using, you know, kind of all the lending abilities, from credit cards to second mortgages to, you know, bank loans, you know, on the business with lien on your house. And then private equity, Blackstone became our growth partner in Bridger to do a large expansion of our fleet. You know, that was $150 million of private equity structured investment. We brought in venture capital for our technology company after the spin out. That was eventually sold to a strategic, CACI, in 2020. And then, of course, yep, now we're at the point where we are, we went through our IPO last about a year ago, and now we're publicly traded on the NASDAQ. So I've kind of gone through all the different financial machinations that you can go through as a small business owner. And it's been an adventure. And obviously being publicly traded has great benefits, has great downsides. But the reality, you know, we love this business. It's got a long-term horizon for success. The market will love us one day, hate us the next. That's the reality of being publicly traded. Stock will go up, stock will go down. But we know the fundamentals of our business are strong. We got great assets. We got long-term contracts, and we're servicing, a growing need. And most importantly, it's a fantastic mission.
It really is.
No offense to yoga pant companies and dating apps, but we're doing something very important for the American West. We're protecting communities from wildfire, and it's an amazing mission, and we're proud to do it.
Well, the yoga in me definitely agrees. So thank you for all of that. What really led to all these different decisions at every juncture was the fact that you were on a very, very fast growth path. What did you do to manage that from a people standpoint? The human element is not easy there. You're at 400 employees now over basically, dare I say, 10 years. That's fast growth. And especially with a market like yours, what did you do to really manage that and make sure that you were hiring and firing the right people?
Yeah, it absolutely is the hardest part. I mean, raising money is always a challenge. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we, 9 years to the day almost is when we started the company. So yeah, we're literally a 9-year anniversary right about now. And, that was quite honestly during a time where growth companies were, everybody wanted to grow. So to be quite honest, raising money for growth companies was easier than it is now. I mean, this year we've seen a dramatic turn of the market. I think these conditions are going to be here to stay, very openly and honestly. I'm honest with everybody. We tried to do a secondary stock offering a couple of weeks ago, and it was very clear the market was not interested in, it wasn't us. It was just the market conditions, whether it's World War III, people are thinking of starting, interest rates going nuts. The deficit spending of debt, whatever it is, the markets right now are pulled back. They're in a bearish position and probably going to be there for a while. So, getting financing over our 9-year trajectory, we were in a period of frankly easy money, especially for startups. So our biggest challenge was exactly what you said, which was getting people. We're in Montana, so we're in a rural economy. Obviously we're in Bozeman, we're outside of Bozeman, Belgrade. Which is, still a cool techie town, so to speak, in Montana, but it's still Montana, and Bozeman's still a 40,000 person town. So getting people here, was always going to be a challenge. Luckily, the reason we chose this valley was MSU, which personally very well.
Yeah.
It's a great technology school. And for our engineers, it was an amazing talent source for us. And what we were offering for them was the opportunity to be an engineer working on innovative projects and stay in Montana. Most people in Montana don't want to leave. It's a great place to live. And if they're engineers, they want to do something exciting. They want to design, aircraft and defense systems and, optics, infrared. I mean, the stuff we're doing here is really fun. And I think, for some of them, they look at, well, I can go be a civil engineer and, design, plumbing systems and highways. And that's very important stuff. But is it as exciting as designing, the next gen air defense system for the Marine Corps or working on aerial firefighting planes? So I think, we had, and then our veteran founding team, we had a great talent pool for management and leadership coming from the veteran community. So really drawing on the MSU for our engineering talent and drawing on the veteran community that, at one point, we were one of the largest private veteran employers in the state, aside from the government. So using veterans and leveraging them, this hire a vets theme that we're seeing now, I love it and I'm so supportive of it, but I don't like the tone of it because the tone of it is hire veterans out of pity, hire veterans.
That's not what this is about.
No, it's more like we have an amazing workforce in the veteran community. They're mission
and
oriented.
Work ethic.
They know how to get things done. They know how to work as a team. You don't hire them because you feel bad for them. Hire them because you're lucky to have them. And I have been able to take advantage of that theme where a lot of companies don't value veteran applicants because they just don't understand them. And we've been able to get an amazing team built around that. So now, of course, it doesn't always work out. And at times you've got to realize, when certain members of your team, that the hardest thing about running a startup like this fast growth is sometimes early team members that you love like family. They've been with you for years and it's just not working anymore.
You outgrow them.
And the company outgrows them. And sometimes they aren't able to, they were an amazing team leader when you had 8 people. When you have 50, it's different. And they either can't continue to fill that leadership role or they're unwilling to say, listen, I can no longer be in the C-suite. I'm just not designed for this. And that's been the hardest thing is managing that kind of personal growth. Some people are amazing to watch them grow with the company. Some people are amazing in seeing their humility to say, listen, I was a great vice president when we were 20 people. Now that we're 200 people, I'm not ready for this role anymore. Let me step down. I want to stay with the company and focus on this instead. And sometimes it means people just have to go away and go on their own journey.
Yeah. But, and that's what you hope, is that they can self-select, right? And say, you know, I'm better suited in this area. What percentage
and
of your
I'm team? I'm the first to say that too. I'm the first to tell my team and our investors, say, listen, there's probably going to be a time where, you know, I'm a growth CEO. I'm an innovation type guy. There's probably going to be a time where you guys say, hey, you know, some say Apple's best days were after Steve Jobs left, you know, and sometimes me as the founder may say, hey, founders can be amazing builders and creators. Oftentimes a company gets to the point where the founder becomes their greatest obstacle, where it's like, hey, you need to get out of the way. You're too emotionally connected to the product, to the team, to the company. Like, this thing needs to be optimized, and it's going to take a new leader to do that.
Yeah. You know, most fast growth companies start out with a really, really strong sales team to just build the idea in the mindset of those early adopters and the new audiences. How has marketing impacted your growth? And, you know, what would you share with our audience today about the importance of marketing?
Yeah, I mean, my customer base isn't a typical consumer kind of, you know, so like, typical marketing isn't what we've ever done, just because we've largely been transacting with government customers or large corporate customers, kind of in a B2G or B2C or as a B2B concept. So kind of traditional, you know, digital ad marketing stuff typically hasn't been in our DNA. But I think at the end of the day, you know, it all comes down to the same thing. And that is, you know, what's the one thing you want people to walk away remembering about your company? Because whether they're the government, whether they're consumers, whether they're a business, you know, people only remember 10% of what they hear, and you got to be careful what you put in front of them. And you want to make sure that, especially their first impression, because you may not control their first impression. Mm-hmm. And therefore you got to be very careful about, you know, for us, what the paint job on our aircraft is, you know, what's the apparel our team's going to wear in the field? What are our maintenance trailers painted like for our defense business? You know, what does our product look like when it comes out of the box? Because these people are not going to be exposed to traditional marketing, in the likes of Apple or Chevrolet or, you know, Boeing. So we've got to put things out there that the customer will remember, and your brand needs to be consistent across, you know, your product, your software, your apparel, your website, and everything you put out there. So it's clear that whatever segment they interact with, they're probably not going to see the picture you want them to see. So you better ensure your brand is consistent, so that whatever piece of your chain they interact with, they take away whatever message you want to deliver. And for us, and all of our companies, it's always been mission. I want them to know what our mission is, and I want them to understand what our mission is as a customer. And that's always to save lives. Just the bottom line, one of our companies was designing defense systems to protect our troops at war. Another one is to fight wildfires and protect our communities. And everything you see from us, it's pretty easy to see what we do. We fight fire for a living at Bridger Aerospace. That's our job. That's why we exist.
And you have just defined the epitome of what brand marketing is all about. It's, you know, it's building all those elements so that the customer talks about you in a way that you are hopeful of. At the end of the day, they have control over the perception of the brand. And that is exactly what we want to be able to position in the marketplace. And you've done a beautiful job with that. You know, I must say that part of it ties into thought leadership. You are constantly in social media. I followed you on LinkedIn, which is how I began to just have tremendous respect for you and the position you're creating in the marketplace. How methodical was that thought leadership strategy, or was it just more innate for you as an entrepreneur and a business leader?
Yeah, it never really intentionally tried to become a, you know, a thought leader. I think you probably are well aware there's a lot of folks out there that they think of themselves as thought leaders. You know, they're a thought leader in their own mind. And, you know, I think they're so busy crafting themselves as a thought leader that, you know, they're not actually doing anything. And my belief's always been, you know, nothing speaks louder than actions, you know, just do. And if you do, you know, everything else will follow in place. So I've never been particularly active on social media until really the last year, for obvious reasons. And, you know, I didn't even have social media prior to that, just because it was kind of, I had a LinkedIn account basically, because in this day and age, you kind of have to just, it's also just so much easier to just connect with people instead of training business cards and all that. But, you know, having tangible results within our business and just you know, it's no different than the military, where, you know, the most effective leaders in the military are not those who have been appointed to a rank or given authority. It's what we call emergent leaders. And emergent leaders are those that, you know, you put 50 guys in the woods with rucksacks and rifles with no rank on, which is what you do basically in Ranger school. Nobody has a rank. And, you know, within a couple of days, someone will be the leader of that group, an emergent leader. Someone emerges as the person that when everyone's cold and tired and hungry and hasn't slept in days, who's the person that they coalesce behind and follow? And, you know, the reality is it happens naturally. It's not always pretty how it happens, but emergent leaders do emerge and will earn that place of respect. And I think it's no different, you know, for us in the marketplace. We've had our ups and downs. Starting a business, you're going to get scraped. You're going to get punched in the face. You just got to keep driving forward. And I was almost killed in a plane crash in 2019, you know, and luckily walked away. But by continuing to execute, you know, people will notice and eventually you'll become a thought leader.
Well, and you are on so many different levels. And it's something interesting here, especially in the entrepreneurial startup space, and you're way beyond that at this stage. But I think a lot of people confuse communications with marketing, and you happen to have a very, very strong communications team that is helping you really build the infrastructure internally, internal communications, as well as externally. Yeah, you know, I agree. Digital marketing is not going to be who you are and what you need by any stretch of the imagination. But communications is what you are deploying, and you're doing a phenomenal job.
Great. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Thank you.
How did you build the communications team?
You know, I think it's we don't really have much of a communications team. We have one, you know, one guy at Bridger that Devin, he does an amazing job kind of managing our marketing across our platforms and you know, it as long as you're thoughtful with what you put out there. And I think oversaturation is a challenge. Sometimes you see that companies try to communicate too much across too many different avenues, and it just gets diluted. So I think my style of communication has always tried to be, and I think it's carried over to Bridger, is, you know, There's no requirement to share five times a day or once a day or even once a week. You know, share when things matter and are relevant. And I think that leads to a more focused engagement with people who are interested in what you have to say. Because again, I mean, people are inundated with content today, just inundated with everything. I mean, there's so much content being thrown at them. And I think, you know, instead of trying to outpace all the content they're getting, just being more deliberate about what you share and ensuring that what you share is of higher quality. I think that really helps you punch through the noise, because there's so much noise right now, whether it's social media, whether it's digital advertising, whether it's streaming services, there's so much noise. You know, having a focused message that, you know, maybe that means you don't post for a month at a time, but, you know, when you do post, you know, ensure it's around something that is impactful.
Yeah, I agree. And you've got the audience to make sure that happens. What is one thing, as we close up our time together today, that you said to yourself, I'm never going to do that again?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of that, but
I know I've got a whiteboard next to me with my list on it.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing is, as you grow your team, you know, when you get that gut feeling about adding someone to the team, you know, listen to that gut feeling, especially if you're the leader and the founder of the team, because, you know, a lot of times you'll get pressure from the rest of the, oh, we need this guy, we need this role, got to have this woman, got to have this guy, whatever it is. And, you know, maybe on paper they look good, but then when you sit down and talk to them, you're kind of like, man, this just doesn't feel right. You know, I've been talked into a lot of hires by my team against my gut, and almost invariably, you know, it's ended up biting us later on. So, yeah. You know, as the founder, especially as a young company, you know, culture is important. I know everyone says that, and, you know, all these buzzwords, but the reality is, you know, especially in the early days of a company, there's going to be really tough times. You're going to have to miss payroll. You're going to have to tell people, hey guys, you know, we're not getting paid this month. Or, you know, I know we were planning on bonuses, not going to happen. Like, we're a startup, we're scraping by. And sometimes the only thing that'll save you is the cohesion of the team, the culture, the dynamic you have, and the respect that they have for you as a leader. And one of the quickest ways to ruin all those things is, you know, allowing, you know, some toxic members into your team. And, you know, especially during those tough times as a startup, When you need all cylinders firing and you need a team unified behind a common goal, the quickest way to ruin that is having toxic people in there. So, you know, be very deliberate about who you're bringing in. No matter how much you may need that skill, no matter how much you may need more people, you know, if when you're interviewing those folks, you have that gut feel, listen to it, because, you know, you're going to end up being the one who has to clean up that mess down the road.
Yeah. Do you feel that gut feeling is due in part to your SEAL training?
You know, I'm sure partially, but I think anybody who has, you know, the vision and gumption to become a founder, you know, starting a company is not easy no matter who you are.
Yeah.
I think, you know, normally you're going to have that sixth sense about you. You're not always going to have it. I mean, you're going to screw up and think that you're about to hire the best person in the world, and you realize you screwed up. Sometimes you're the worst offender. You're the one bringing somebody in that everyone else is saying, hey, we're getting red flags.
Don't do that again.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So,
I guess really the moral is, you know, just trust your gut on that, but also trust your team too. You know, if you got the gut that someone's awesome, and then, you know, some of your early founders with you or your early team saying, hey, we're not getting a good feeling too. You know, it's hire slow, fire fast, I think is an absolutely true statement. You know, and be very deliberate about building that early team, because that early team really will make or break whether your enterprise is successful or not.
Well, Tim, I tell you, you have shared so many insights with us today. You've got a ton on your plate. We thank you so much for taking the time aside to speak with our audience today. You're an inspiration. Good luck with everything that you've got going on in the future. And thank you so much for your appearance on the Integrate and Ignite podcast.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
This episode is complete. Head over to avasetcommunications.com for more ways to scale and grow your business. And be sure to tune in regularly for insights and motivation with host Lori Jones and her guests on the Integrate and Ignite Marketing Podcast.